This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Still in the same case, we're still talking about the Huerman case and the family sessions. The therapist who heard Rex Huerman confess to 8 murders and help facilitate those family meetings is now a defendant herself. The Peacock documentary put those raw sessions on camera. Now the woman at the center of them faces prison time for practicing without a license. Eric Faddis walks us through whether this creates any legal openings for Huerman, potential challenges to the plea, or fallout for Asa and Victoria's public statements. So with that, kind of diving back in on this, Huerman confessed to his ex-wife and daughter during sessions involving Winter. If she wasn't legally qualified to be there, could that confession or those family statements be attacked in a future proceeding? We kind of covered this on the last segment, but let's do another little deep dive on that and any other nuances you've thought of.
You know, I see Huerman's attorneys looking at this and saying he pled guilty because he... In large part, because he gave a confession. And at that juncture, he knew, man, it's lights out, it's over. I've told people this stuff. You know, there might be some kind of privilege or protections, but I'm worried this is going to get out. They're going to subpoena my wife and my daughter, and this is going to be a huge problem for my family. That's the reason I'm going to go ahead and plead guilty. Well, if that reason is then taken out from under them because that confession was elicited in a fraudulent and deceptive fashion, does that undercut the motivations behind entering a plea? And does that change in those circumstances and those motivations underlying that plea entitle a defendant to say, hey, I wouldn't have done this otherwise. I wouldn't have pled guilty if this confession wasn't wrung out of me in some sort of conned fashion by this con woman. That could be an argument we see on appeal. I'm not sure how successful it'll be, but that would be a creative avenue.
Yeah, I'm also curious, Eric. So now that she wasn't licensed during all these sessions, does HIPAA still, kick in for her? In other words, is there any privileged information anymore from any of these conversations? In other words, can all these things be opened up now to scrutiny because she wasn't a practicing clinician? I mean, it's really interesting, is it? Or can he claim some sort of thing against her for that?
You know, Robin, let's say that, let's say Todd goes to somebody whom he believes is an attorney, and Todd confesses to all the horrible stuff he's done over his life.
Bad Todd.
I'm kidding. He wouldn't have anything to confess. He's a saint. But let's hypothetically say he did. And then it turns out the person to whom he was speaking is just some Joe Schmo off the street. It's not an attorney. So typically when you confide an attorney, when you give secrets to an attorney, that's protected. There's confidentiality and there's a privilege, meaning the attorney can't testify against you. But if that individual is not an actual attorney, does that privilege apply? Does that confidentiality apply? You know, the policy reasons behind that privilege would indicate yes. The policy reasons are we want folks to be able to confide in these professionals for their own, sometimes their own legal protection, sometimes for their own recovery from whatever issues they're contending with. That person would have the same expectations, regardless of whether the individual to whom they were confiding was an actual licensed whatever. But would the law see it that way? I haven't seen such a case come up. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if it did come up, if a judge said, hey, we're giving you the privilege and the confidentiality anyway, because you expected that this person was legit. They weren't. That's not your fault, bro.
So no lemon law, like buyer beware of the unlicensed clinician that made her way in.
Yeah, I don't think it's like, you know, you have to confirm the credentials and their active status of a person in whom you're confiding before that privilege and confidentiality protections can apply. I don't think that burden is on the individual going to some professional for help.
So that burden of providing credentials and verifying credentials, that falls on the jail? Who's that fall on?
Yeah, it falls in part on the state, and they have determined that no such credentials existed according to them, and so they're brought criminal charges. In terms of allowing the visits, allowing these things to happen, I'm not sure that there is that it, the burden squarely falls upon anyone. I think it's just sort of a fluid situation in which there might be shifting responsibility among multiple parties and to varying degrees.
That's really interesting, isn't it? It's like one of the greatest examples of social engineering we've seen in a while. I mean, even in the FBI, I mean, just you talk about what people are willing to do over a phone. I mean, I would part of my collateral duty. So I was a spy hunter, interviewer, you know, all the hooky spooky spy stuff and everything inside the bureau I did for years and running the behavioral team. But the collateral duties we'd get, we would get taskings from headquarters. So because I'm in the Northern Virginia area, D.C. area. So anytime there's a new elected official, a new president, they're all their appointees go through background clearances, you know, for appointments. And so we have to do a lot of security interviews for people to get clearances, you know, for the entire cabinet, other staff members. And so typically, you know, you want to have someone show up at your doorstep, show your FBI credentials. Although, I mean, even how do you, I mean, it says FBI credentials. I mean, mine are behind me right there. Those are my retired ones back there. People would just take it for granted that you are who you say you are. I would actually call people on the phone. I mean, so here's the way I would allow people to verify this on the phone, which is even more unofficial. I'd call them on the phone and say, listen, my name's Robin. I work counterintelligence in the local office here at the FBI. I'm doing a background investigation for so-and-so going for an official government position. Would you mind to talk to me for a few minutes about their background, what you think of them, if that's something you're comfortable doing? If not, here's a phone number, or you can look it up on your own. You can call the Richmond office of the FBI, ask for me. They'll direct you back to me, and you can do that to verify who I am. That's all it took. And people would spill their guts. Now, who's liable in the situations like that? Is she, obviously she's liable and she's being found guilty of this. But I mean, brings up that really interesting question, especially when you're dealing with such high stakes things like someone's life, your life in prison, about who verifies they are who they say they are.
Totally. And, you know, you think about Robin, if this person was not a licensed social worker, they could have been anyone. Couldn't they have been, you know, a gang member trying to recruit Rex Hurlman to do horrible things inside of a facility? That's a problem for the facility. That's a problem for the other inmates. Could they be, who knows, an escape artist who is going to try to help break Rex Hurlman custody? There are just unlimited concerns when it comes to the lack of verification in terms of this person's identity.
So we know that, and I want to go back to Alec Murdoch. You know, he's suing Becky Hill, all that kind of stuff. Rex Hurlman can't turn around and say, hey, I'm going to sue this individual for playing the part of a licensed therapist on TV, but not actually being one. He doesn't even have that amount of ammunition in his back pocket.
He might have some kind of legal claim against the social worker. He would have to prove that he was fraudulently induced into disclosing private facts, and that disclosure caused him damages. Certainly it caused him reputational damages. Were some of the damages impairment of his criminal case because he thought, oh, the confession's out there. One form or another, it's out there. And that's, I've got to plead guilty now. I'm screwed. I was already screwed. I'm even more screwed now. You know, could there be such a claim against, could Rex have such a claim? I think he probably in theory could pursue such a claim. Not sure how far it'd go, but possibly.
Talk about claims. Now, Asa's and Rex's daughter, Victoria, she was a teenager during many of the later murders, and she sat in these sessions with an unlicensed therapist. Could this give her any civil claim against the county or Winter herself, do you think?
You know, it would depend in part on the county's involvement, the institution's involvement. For example, Robin, if in arranging this whole thing, there was a jail official and they called up Victoria and they said, hey, look, we've got a licensed social worker here. We want to try to have this candid discussion about some really tough stuff. Would you be willing to come in? You know, this person is trained and they know what they're doing. And would you be willing to do that? If that was an inaccurate representation in terms of that to which they were inviting Victoria, I think Victoria could feel rightly aggrieved that, hey, I was duped into coming in here in something that's extraordinarily painful and private for my family, and that might even hurt my dad's chances in the criminal case. But I came because I was told by the institution that this was all on the up and up. I think under those circumstances, she might have a claim against the institution for negligent infliction of emotional distress or some similar claim. And I think that could be viable, but it really depends on what the institution, the positions they had, the representations they made to the family.
Yeah, and also part of Huerman's plea deal was also cooperation with the FBI's BAU. And do you think that this revelation impacts that at all, or anything moving forward with what he's going to share?
Yeah, you know, gosh, if I was him, I'd probably be a lot more cautious. I'd say, hey, the last time I opened up about the most secret and serious thing in my life, I was completely misled. I was taken for. And I don't want that to happen again. That's a crummy feeling for anybody. Even if you're a serial killer, it's a crummy feeling for you too. And so is that going to make him more cautious when it comes to such conversations in the future? Yeah, in this future, yeah, they say it's the FBI, and they say that it's going to be, you know, essentially intellectual and scholastic, academic, and not investigative. But I've been lied to before, man. So could this have a chilling effect on the information Rex Hurlman brings forward throughout the remainder of his life? I fear that it could. And that'd be a detriment to the FBI, be a detriment to behavioral science, it'd be a detriment to public safety.
Yeah. So, you know, playing that one forward a little bit. So does her actions then, either legally or definitely mentally for Huerman, undermine that plea deal, the fact that cooperation because of this in any way? And if he does withhold information, or even the perception of withholding information and the transparency which he agreed to with BAU, does the FBI have any legal recourse then against Winter?
Yeah.
I ask you brain twisters, man.
You know, I don't think the FBI would – I don't think there's any such claim for, like, tortious interference in FBI investigation. Now, there are charges for obstruction, for interference in governmental operations, things like that. And could this non-social worker's actions stymie some future investigation? I guess that is possible. But I think it's really just a big mess for which there are not many great legal remedies for anybody.
Yeah. And so during this entire thing, right at the sentencing, the judge during sentencing called Huerman disgusting and had him removed. If Winter's credentials do come under fire as they have, does it undermine the whole therapeutic process that led to the plea, do you think? And what do you think? Will this? Can you imagine any world where this becomes a kind of new case law on how they verify credentials going into prisons? Or has this happened so frequently that they just ignore it?
You know, gosh, if I'm defense counsel on a case and someone comes to me and they say, hey, we want your client to engage in this therapeutic process. We think that it might make it more likely that we reach a resolution in the case, but he needs to be open and everything like that. I am a lot more vigilant at this point. I am a lot more skeptical and distrustful of the state. There was a comment here by Lorna in 1969 about just losing faith in the system. My gosh, you want to talk about for whom should there be the highest security clearance measures taken in terms of inmates? Well, probably a nationally publicized serial killer who's alleged to have killed at least 8 people. Yeah. And then those protections totally fail in a case like this. Gosh, I'm not so inclined to subject any client to such a purportedly therapeutic process, especially if the last time it wasn't even a real therapist.
Yeah. Last question on this one before we start moving on, Eric. So, because I'm really fascinated by this aspect of it was privileged information from these interviews in the past. Now, granted, if he had disclosed any other murders or anything he had done, she would have be compelled to share that anyway, correct? Even if, you know, if she was licensed or unlicensed, correct? Or no? Or because where I'm getting at is, do investigators now have a more free hand to go and request her journals, her logs, her notes, and go through those and to see what other kind of leakage might be in there to other things he might have done in other states, say North Carolina or something like that, or in Vegas?
Yeah.
Or is it protected because she was posing as a therapist?
I would tend to think that it's protected because she was posing as a therapist. Now, the government might disagree. The government might say this protection applies to therapists. She's not a therapist. Therefore, the protection does not apply. Whereas defense is going to say this protection applies to the therapeutic context, and it's based on the patient's expectation of privacy and confidentiality. And so that would be a fight in court. And, you know, could government authorities get their hands on such records, not call the therapist to testify against Rex, and not but then use that information to develop further leads, to try to develop independent bases right. of that information, because they were able to acquire it because she's not a therapist. It wouldn't be the first time that such actions were taken. And if the government had like an independent, separate basis, separate and apart from this therapeutic context for the same information, I think that information might be fair game.
Yeah, does it become fruit of the poisonous tree if they later determine that they couldn't have taken information from there that led to other information that was other crimes or anything? Or, I mean, I know this becomes really complicated, doesn't it?
It's only fruit of the poisonous tree if the poison originated with the government. And this Winter person right. was not a government employee, is my understanding. She is just a fake private social worker. And so that constitutional argument, fruit of the poisonous tree, can really only be lodged when there is significant government action that really from which the poison originates. So they have to share.
This is definitely, you know, every time we think one case is done, something springs new and keeps us going on. And this will definitely keep us interested in what's going on, where they go from here. Anyway, your thoughts in the comments section of Substack and YouTube. Give us your thoughts and opinions. We'd love to hear from you. The links are in the descriptions.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.